Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. Are osteopathic medical schools in trouble? Interesting question. Interesting thought experiments that I'm going to have today with our guest. The pre-med year, session number 475. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Welcome to The Pre-Med Years. Thank you so much for joining me today. I have an amazing guest today, someone who I reached out to after I saw a YouTube video of his titled Addressing Osteopathic Medicine's Vulnerabilities, The View Through an External Lens. In that discussion, he was asked by the Osteopathic Medical Schools, by the association, to have a discussion with them about what if, what does the future look like if some things happened? Where are osteopathic schools vulnerable? And potentially, where are you as an osteopathic student vulnerable? I listened to this video or watched this video and immediately wanted to have Dr. Brian Carmody on the podcast to really have a back and forth with him instead of just hearing him talk. I wanted to kind of poke the bear a little bit and see what his thought process was behind this. And where you as a pre-med student potentially going into an osteopathic medical school, where you can make the best decision possible for your future career. We don't just talk about DO versus MD. We also talk about step one going pass fail and a lot more. A lot of these topics I could have Dr. Carmody on over and over and over again to go in depth. So if you enjoy this discussion and you want more of it, let us know. Dr. Carmody is also known as the Sheriff of Sodium. You can find him at thesheriffofsodium.com or at JB Carmody on Twitter. That's JB as in Bob, Carmody, C-A-R-M-O-D-Y. Brian, welcome to the pre-med years. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
When I love asking this question on the pre-med years, even though you're not my typical guest on the show, but when did you first realize you wanted to be a doctor?
That's a good question that I haven't thought about for quite some time.
Bringing back the old med school interview question.
You know, I sometimes talk to people who sort of had a moment of epiphany or they had some grand, moment where they realized it. For me, it was more of sort of a gradual thing. I remember when I was, the idea probably set into my head at first when I was in high school, and I started to explore when I was in college and, shadow some physicians and start to imagine myself, doing that. So it was something that I guess it started early, but I wasn't sure about it up until I applied to medical school and got accepted. And then I guess the rest is history.
Yeah. And so you are a practicing pediatric nephrologist.
Correct.
You run a very active Twitter account. You call yourself the Sheriff of Sodium, which is hilarious. I don't know what it is with nephrologists and Twitter humor. It works really well. There are a lot of great nephrologists on Twitter. What do you think is the cause behind that?
I'll tell you, I mean, the kidney is the most beautiful and intriguing organ in the human body at every level. And so I think you attract a sort of an interesting and unique group of people, into nephrology, whether it's adult or pediatric.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. For someone listening to this, as you are in the stage of your life you're at now as an attending, what is the biggest piece of advice that you love giving out to pre-med students?
Oh man, I don't see a lot of pre-med students. So that's actually one reason that I'm interested to talk to you, because I spend quite a bit of time with medical students and residents and, people sort of at that journey. And that's sort of, the things that I do on social media are all sort of geared toward that. So I don't really see a lot of pre-med students. I think if I were going to give a piece of advice, I think the piece of advice I would give is that you should start early practicing the skill of balancing your life with your work, because it is just not realistic to think that the external world is going to make you have more time for things that you want to prioritize. As you move on, life will stay busy, and you have to sort of come to terms with working hard on whatever your hands are on and then doing something else, and being fully present and engaged in whatever that other thing is. And honestly, it's a skill that I think you need to recite and practice. And it probably starts when you're a pre-med. It's easy to give into the mindset of, I've just got to get through this. I've just got to push myself to the limit and get through this thing. And then real life begins. But if you keep that attitude, real life sort of never begins,
Yeah, I love that. I think we as humans fall into a trap of always reaching for that finish line and only see success as getting the MD, getting the DO, actually being an attending, getting that first big paycheck, and all of these fun, just life experiences along the way we miss out on. And then we're burnt out and we're miserable, when instead, waking up every day and celebrating that A on the midterm, A on the final, whatever it is, are little successes that I think will continue to motivate us and keep us going. So I love that. So I have you here because you put out a video on YouTube of a presentation that you gave to some osteopathic medical schools. The title of your blog post is "The Vulnerabilities of Osteopathic Medicine," with the video addressing osteopathic medicine's vulnerabilities, the view through an external lens. This made the rounds on Reddit, where I found it. I watched it and reached out to you. So I would love to have a conversation with you about your thoughts. First and foremost, just to get this out of the way, you are not a DO, correct? You're an MD?
That's right, I'm not.
Okay.
And I don't work at a DO school. I don't really sort of have any skin in that game. But I am sort of an observer of medical education generally. And not to blow smoke, but I know some stuff about it. And I think that's why I got asked to give this talk to deans, was to provide a different perspective versus the perspective that they may often, hear in their internal discussions.
Yeah. So how did this talk come about? Were you at a conference and just talking about some of your thoughts, and somebody was like, "Hey, you should put together a talk about this," or was it just like, "Hey, Brian, do you have some things that you would be interested talking to osteopathic schools about?" And then you put this together.
Yeah, it was an executive from the from AACOM who asked me to do it, and I'll be honest, when I first got asked, I wondered if there was a particular thing that they wanted to hear about. And I tried to sort of explore that. So I was giving them the content that they wanted. And, And I honestly don't think that they had a particular agenda that they wanted me to talk about. They sort of gave me a blank slate. And so I gave my honest, you know, my honest opinions about that. So the talk itself, you know, was given in November of 2021 to their dean's retreat. And it occurred right before they broke to do strategic planning.
Okay. And what is your experience, if any, working with osteopathic medical students themselves? What is your view on students coming out of osteopathic medical schools?
Yeah, so we do have, you know, at the hospital where I work, we have a fair number of osteopathic students who choose to do electives, you know, during their fourth year at our hospital. We have a residency program that typically, I would say maybe 40% of our residents in recent years have come from osteopathic medical schools. So, my opinion is good. I think that, osteopathic medical students and, you know, residents with a DO degree, I think they do very well for themselves. Mm.
Yeah. So it's interesting watching the video, your, particular insight seems to be mostly around the cost of osteopathic medical schools. And I think anyone who looks at tuition and fees and costs and like a total cost of burden, the burden of tuition and costs and everything going to medical school, like just knows anecdotally that osteopathic medical schools are typically more expensive than their MD counterparts. And obviously you can go find some expensive MD medical schools where I'm on faculty here at University of Colorado School of Medicine. We're one of the more expensive MD medical schools out there. What was your particular interest in looking at cost of attendance for osteopathic medical schools?
Well, yeah. So again, you know, you got to frame this around, you know, what they'd asked me to do, which is to help with strategic planning. And so when I set out to sort of make this talk, I mean, what I tried to envision was a world in which, you know, the osteopathic degree doesn't have the same weight as it does now. And osteopathic medical schools aren't given the same respect that they are now. And if you imagine that world, what would it have taken, you know, based upon clues that are here today, what would it have taken to get there? You know, if we look back at some point in the future and we say, man, you know, 2020, that was as good as it ever got to be a DO in the United States. You know, after that, things really started to deteriorate. Mm-hmm. You know, if that were to take place, you know, what could we have seen coming? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you're right. I mean, if I were going to summarize the talk sort of quickly, I mean, I would say that, you know, recently there's been a large expansion in the number of DO medical schools. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, especially if you believe in osteopathic medicine or believe that we need, you know, more physicians in the United States, well, sure, you know, we need expansion. But if you expand rapidly and the quality of the students that you take in declines, at the same time that the market for resident physicians continues to tighten, mm-hmm. and to be honest, and this is something we could discuss more if it's of interest, I mean, outcomes in the match, in the residency match for osteopathic students are not quite as good as they are for those with the MD degree for, you know, for various reasons. Yeah. And so if you do all that, if you're offering a product that doesn't give you quite the same professional options and it costs more, that's probably not a good combination, you know, for establishing your field as in the way that you want it to be viewed by others.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Someone who wants to go into acting and go to Juilliard isn't going to pay three times as much money to go to some random school in the Midwest where nobody has ever been an actor out of that school, which is kind of the analogy that you're drawing, is why would you pay more for something when at the end of the day, you're potentially not getting what you wanted or expected. And it's a hard conversation to have for a couple reasons. Number one, and I've always made this argument, is it's the individual student that makes up the match, not the school, right? It's the student's performance, both in their preclinical years at the school, both at their rotations, their home rotations, and then their audition electives, their away rotations. And so it's that student, and the school can't really affect how someone performs in those away electives when they're trying to show off to the program director, like, hey, you should really rank me to match. But I don't show up until an hour after everyone else and I leave an hour early. The school can't affect that. So it's always one of those weird conversations. But then also we have this confounding variable of a single accreditation now in 2022, right? Or is it 2020 that it happened? For the single accreditation.
Graduate medical education is now under a single system, run by the ACGME.
Yep. Yeah. And so it's hard to make, especially for these first couple years, it's hard to make good comparisons of match outcomes with the single accreditation. Now that we have one set of numbers to look at instead of the students who did apply through ARIS, the students who applied through the osteopathic match. Now we have everyone going into one match, one set of numbers to run some data on. Do you think it'll be interesting to relook at this in a couple of years when things kind of settle out?
Yeah, although I think it's going to take a while for things to settle out because, a lot of things are changing. Single accreditation is certainly one, but the number of students, entering the match from MD and DO schools and the schools that they come from. When you have newer schools, you have sort of less, institutional experience in getting your students placed in the match and so on. So there's some other variables at play, but yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how things shake out over the next several years.
Explain what you mean, the institutional experience getting people to match. Is that how to write the best kind of dean's letter or actual kind of backroom conversations that may be happening?
Yeah, there's sort of multiple layers of that. So, part of it is, to be frank, part of it is name recognition where, when you're looking at an applicant at a glance and, there are certain fundamental differences between the ways that applications are reviewed for graduate medical education and for undergraduate medical, admissions, like your listeners may be familiar with. Yeah. So that matters. But more fundamentally, when you're a newer school, especially if you're a newer school that's really sort of staking out new territory, many of the new schools, MD and DO, that have expanded and they've set up in more rural areas. Yeah. And there's real benefits to that, but there's a real challenge too, which is getting your students the clinical experience that they need. And often that requires farming students out to various hospitals, in your third and fourth year. And if you have to do that, it helps to have some relationships established with hospitals that will, give your students meaningful opportunities and give them the chance to advance when they apply for residency. So that matters. Yeah. There's all the academic advising that takes place and how you prepare your students to excel on metrics that they're going to be evaluated on. Do you have opportunities for research? Do you have, good opportunities for them to engage in board prep and so on? And all those things, if you're at a mature school that has been doing all that stuff for a while, you probably have relationships with people for away rotations and you probably have your system down pat. If you're a newer school, sometimes you've got to work through that stuff a little bit.
Yeah. It's always been one of the things that I talk to students about is those relationships for the clinical rotations that osteopathic schools, and you talked about this a little bit in your talk, osteopathic schools, for the most part, don't have relationships and aren't in proximity location-wise to big academic medical centers where there's just an obvious like, hey, we're going to send our students here and you'll take them and you'll love them and take care of them and teach them. Osteopathic schools typically aren't associated with those big medical centers, and either the school is doing the work to find placements or the student sometimes has to do the work.
Correct.
To find those placements. And so potentially what you're saying is what we talk about all the time is just a networking standpoint. You just aren't exposed to the people at the end of the day, potentially, who are making those residency match and interview invitation type decisions to just network and build your network as a medical student.
Yeah, correct. I agree with that.
So it's interesting. I'm here in Colorado, just north of us up in Wyoming, Montana, Idaho. Like, there are medical schools that are opening there that historically there haven't been, I think for good reason. Like, there's just not a lot of people up there, right? From a population density standpoint.
Correct.
There's not a lot of people. There's not a lot of people in that state who probably want to go to medical school. And then to go to medical school, to become a good physician, you need exposure to a wide variety of patients. And I think one of your concerns, potentially, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but one of my concerns is that these students, unless they go get some fantastic away rotations or rotations in general, outside of the area where they're training, are probably not going to get exposure to a wide swath of medicine.
No, that's exactly one of my concerns. And I think that that's a vulnerability that needs to be addressed for osteopathic medicine in general. I mean, you can make a credible argument that there are, offsetting benefits to having some rotations in rural areas. And I mean, I think that that's true. I mean, yep. The physicians practice in a different way. You're going to get to see some things managed in different ways. But it's also true that, you know, if you compare to a sort of a typical or traditional MD school where every specialty is sort of housed in the same big giant university of such and such academic medical center, it's easier, you know. I mean, it's easier for their students to get that experience in one place, you know, versus having to cultivate that relationship or pay for that privilege to have your students, rotate, in far-flung hospitals where, you know, they're not all sort of part of the same system, and it's maybe a little bit more strained trying to, make all that work.
Yeah. Talk about it from the standpoint, one of your big discussions in the video was about loan forgiveness. We're on a big kick here in this country. One of the Democratic or Democrats kind of talking points for the election and post-election has been a lot of loan forgiveness. How does that affect, in your mind, a student's decision to go to osteopathic medical school or not?
Well, it could apply to many MD schools too, because, I mean, like you said, I mean, on average, and I think this is true even when accounting for the fact that there's a greater proportion of osteopathic medical schools that are private versus public. But even accounting for that, osteopathic medical education is going to cost you a little bit more, you know, in general than an MD education would. Mm. It's a big deal. I mean, you can come out of medical school with quite a bit of debt. It can really impact your life. And if you have a plan to do a loan repayment program, I mean, that really can be life changing if you're going to be somebody who's saddled with a lot of debt. I mean, if you do one of these income based repayments or public service repayments, which are currently an option, And I mean, certainly, I mean, as you suggest, I mean, there's politically things that are being batted about a certain amount of loan forgiveness sort of for all comers or for people who meet certain requirements. And I mean, those things could happen. But I mean, alternatively, you could have a political system in the future where, there was a less willingness to entertain these kinds of loan forgiveness. So, I mean, I did suggest that I think that's a political thing that osteopathic leaders should be working actively on, to strengthen their schools. I mean, you have schools that expand into these rural areas. You have politicians who have supported that. And I think those politicians need to be continued to be lobbied and, to encourage other forms of loan forgiveness for, if you have graduates who come back to that area and sort of fulfill the school's mission, I think that you should push the politicians to reward the students who do that.
Yeah.
You know, now whether that'll happen, I mean, that's sort of, it's hard to make a prediction about that. It's politics, you know?
Yeah. Talk about, and I'm trying to find this specific slide where you talked about it, but you talked about budgets, basically, for medical schools and the large percentage of kind of revenue for osteopathic schools being tuition versus the allopathic medical schools the tuition was a lot smaller percentage of their overall revenue. And that was something that kind of caught me off guard, I think, is something that I didn't understand, potentially the relationship between the hospital and the medical school getting money from the hospital. Talk about that relationship.
Yeah, so so essentially, you know, MD schools, for the most part, and recently, you know, there's some exceptions to this, but in general, most MD granting schools are attached to a giant academic medical center. You can think of the, you know, the famous hospital in your state or whatever that's attached to the you know, the MD medical school, but it's a ginormous financial enterprise, you know, that brings in tons of revenue. The medical school is often administratively housed alongside the revenue that comes in from, you know, patient care at the hospital. And what that means is that tuition revenue comprises a very small portion at the average MD school, a very small portion of their overall revenue. You know, such that if you cut it out altogether, I mean, yeah, the money would have to come from somewhere. I mean, it's not that, you know, things would be free, but there's a giant pot of money that, that could, in theory, you know, be allocated to cover that if people wanted it to. Mm-hmm. And you know, of course, every hospital is different, and sometimes there's silos erected between different piles of money. But in contrast, osteopathic medical schools are generally just schools. There's not a whole lot of revenue coming in from you know, state and local governments. There's not a whole lot of revenue coming in from patient care unless there's an affiliated academic medical center. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not a lot of research activity that draws in NIH funded grants. And what that means is that you have a complex financial enterprise that's really dependent on a single revenue stream, and that is tuition. Mm-hmm. And that means that and that's why I highlight it as a vulnerability, because anything in the future that changes students' willingness to pay higher and higher tuition, or your ability to get loans for your students to allow you to keep doing higher and higher tuition, any of those things are going to render your institution very vulnerable to whatever stress, you know, may occur in the future.
I'm very confused, and I'm looking at the chart here. It's about 16 minutes and 15 seconds into your talk. Why would the practice plan, meaning insurance and delivering patient care, why would that money go to the medical school as part of their revenues?
Well, practice plan here is describing the money that's brought in from sort of faculty medical practice.
Okay.
So if you're at the university of such and such, and you're a, you know, an endocrinologist, you may be in the medical school and paid through the medical school, but the patients that you see generate revenue that's classified as the practice plan. So yeah, if anybody's looking at that video, that big slice of the pie, that refers to, you know, faculty medical practice.
Right. But I'm trying to understand why you included that number as part of the school revenues. How does that affect the performance of the school to where it's not a vulnerability for MD schools, but it is for DO schools? That's what I'm trying to understand here.
Well, imagine that you had a world where, and I go through this sort of in the talk. I mean, right now there is little underwriting that needs to occur for someone to get student loans. You know, if you go out and get a mortgage, or if you go out and try to buy a car, you know, people will look at your credit score and they'll verify bank accounts, or, you know, things of that nature to ensure that you're, you know, that you can have a credible belief that the money that you borrow is going to be paid back. Well, for student loans, and I mean, I went to medical school on student loans. Man, nobody asked me nothing about any of that. You know,
here's your money.
You just sign your name. Right. Exactly. How much do you need? You know, the school says you can have this much. How much do you want? And, you know, I remember it's sort of a awe-inspiring experience. But but imagine that in the future, we lived in a world where at least some underwriting occurs because, for instance, suppose that courts decide that if your students don't match, and they incur $400,000 of debt and they can't obtain a residency position and they can't practice and they can't ever repay that debt, well, maybe those debts should all be discharged in bankruptcy. And you know, there's potentially some, you know, some legal precedents that have been set that may allow that to occur. Well, if you know, if that happens and 5% of your students don't match, and each of those, you know, that 5% is incurring $400,000 of debt, I mean, there's going to have to be some additional scrutiny that occurs on the school or on the student to say, yeah, you know, we can't justify giving you this much money because 1 in 20 people is going to default on this loan, you know? Mm. So if you have something like that, and tuition is a small portion of your sort of institutional lifeblood, it's not that big of a deal if you couldn't increase tuition, you know, because you have so much revenue. I mean, you have 10, 20, 30, 50 times as much revenue coming in from, you know, from research grants, from, you know, from faculty medical practice, et cetera. It would be possible if you were the, you know, the leader of the school to offset and continue your medical education enterprise, you know, just with money taken from somewhere else. On the other hand, if you're at an osteopathic school where you do not have those revenue streams, you're sort of sitting on a stool with one leg. And if somebody kicks out that tuition revenue leg, it really could put you in a desperate financial situation.
Yeah. Got it. So a lot more context around that makes a little bit more sense. It's that yellow in this graph here, again, about 60 minutes, 15 seconds into your talk, at least where I'm at, that practice plan money is more of a, in the future, potentially, if tuition money is harder and harder to come by, where else may there be a buffer, right? How much money is in mommy and daddy's bank account that we can steal from?
Right.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because just the practice of medicine itself, especially for hospitals, is if you look at just how much revenue is generated, how much profit is generated, depending on the hospital. Not every hospital out there is very profitable. And so I look at that big yellow $576 million going, I don't know how much actually there is net that can actually be lent to the school to help out. But it's interesting to see what potentially is out there.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I mean, that's true. But there's other advantages to having that because, you know, you can imagine if you're in an academic center that has, you know, that serves that need for the state. Well, you know, you employ a ton of people and those people vote and you have politicians that are very sympathetic to, you know, whatever it is that you need. You know, you're not sort of left out on your own because you're, I mean, any giant academic medical center, I mean, they're one of the biggest employers in the state, typically.
Yeah, and more of one of the more powerful lobbying bodies in that state, probably as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So that makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about it. I'm going to do a thought experiment. I don't think this was in your talk, but I hear more and more about income sharing agreements. Are you familiar with these?
You probably want to give me a little bit of background.
So income sharing agreements, I don't know when they started. I first heard about them more in the tech industry, where instead of going to a traditional four-year college, come to our coding school. We're going to teach you how to code so that you can go get a job at Google. And we're not going to charge you. You're going to give us a percentage of your salary up to a certain percent or a certain dollar amount in the future. And come get your education now. Don't worry about paying us. And then go get your high-paying job at Google. There are undergraduate institutions that are jumping on board with this. Purdue, I believe, is one of the biggest ones with some of their majors. And one of their engineering majors has it. I listened to a great podcast with the dean of Purdue talking about it, to where the student goes to college, gets their degree, technically comes out with no loans, but has a contract that says a percentage of their salary that they're going to make moving forward is going to go back to their undergraduate institution. So it gives people more flexibility in the choices of jobs that they want to go get or have to go get, maybe is a better term, because they don't have this huge number looming over their head of student debt. I think medical school is just the perfect opportunity for this to where potentially we could get more and more people going into specialties that they want to go into, not that they think they need to go into, to pay back their loans. So imagine going to medical school for free with a percentage of your future salary, whatever that may, that salary may be, whether it's $100,000 because you're an academic physician, or $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 because you're a private practice orthopod, whatever that may be. What are your thoughts on that, just as a fun thought experiment?
So my off-the-cuff thoughts, I would be very hesitant to pursue that personally.
Yeah.
So me, it may help to know a little bit of my background. I grew up in a small town in southwestern Virginia out in the Appalachian Mountains. And so we're sort of used to, you know, the man trying to take advantage of us hillbillies out there. So I'm always a little bit skeptical of things like this because of the default position that such a deal would not be offered unless the person offering it felt like they were going to come out ahead. And sure, you can beat the house, but and I would want to sort of more thoughtfully analyze it before I would rule it out altogether. But your freedom in the jobs that you take and how you work those jobs is a real asset. And you never know if something like that may paint you into a corner. And so it depends how certain you are about your career path and what the alternative would be. But and I could imagine something like that, as you suggest, could work out for a certain number of people. But my initial bias would be probably against it.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I'll send you some info offline about it. You can do a little more research. Talk about the match and what that's potentially going to look like in the future for MD students, for osteopathic students, with both single accreditation and step one going pass fail. We got lots of confounding variables here for the future of graduate medical education.
Yeah, there's much I could talk about with that. And your listeners, I don't know sort of how much they know about the match, because to be honest, I sort of knew vaguely about it when I went to medical school, but I didn't know all the details. I sort of figured things would work out, and in my case, they did. But there are certain specialties. It's just not the case that everyone who wants to be, say, a neurosurgeon or a dermatologist, not everyone is going to get that opportunity. Yep. You apply, and in those highly competitive fields, maybe 75 or 80% of those who apply and rank those programs number one end up matching there. And even that is sort of a best case scenario, because many applicants are deterred from even applying in those specialties because they don't believe they'll be successful. So among the ones who have enough confidence to apply still in some of those specialties, such as, plastic surgery or neurosurgery, or orthopedic surgery or otolaryngology or dermatology, those fields, still maybe, 3/4 of people successfully match. Mm-hmm. So it's competitive. And in those highly competitive fields, MD applicants are preferred, and sometimes that impact is significant. And it's hard to talk about these things without seeming like you're biased. But I mean, the real numbers are that, last year I was looking at this for different reasons a day or two ago. There were 6 osteopathic senior medical students who matched in neurosurgery. There were 2 who matched in plastic surgery.
Yep.
So it's not that it's impossible. And like you said, I mean, your mileage may vary, but you're going to have to walk a very narrow path. And exactly what that path will look like is a little bit more fraught than it used to be, because, 5 years ago, the answer was, you need to score extremely highly on step one, and then, do strong away rotations and so on. But the first step was to excel in step one. And now, as you suggested, with step one scores going pass fail, that makes it a little bit more uncertain for how some applicants will choose to distinguish themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my guess, and talking to lots of program directors, since this was rumored and now has become true, is that the weight of step one and their selection criteria is just going to move to step two because that's still scored. So I would have loved to see all of the steps going pass fail, because it's very interesting, as you had mentioned, right? Students self-selecting out of certain specialties because they don't think they're going to be successful. Most of that decision is based on a step score, unfortunately, I think. And we have the opposite as well, I think, where students are getting their step score back going, well, I've always thought about pediatrics because I love children and it's just what I've always dreamt about. But hey, like I have ortho step score material. So I'm going to go into ortho, not even pediatric ortho, just ortho. Just a hypothesis that I think we have more burnout than necessary in medicine. There are lots of reasons for burnout, but I think we have more than necessary because people are choosing specialties based on what they can do, not necessarily what they want to do. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think much of that's true. So, I agree with you that step two will become the most common screening metric. And you know, we could talk about why that is, but to get to your second point, I think that it is a big contributor in medicine that to burnout, that I guess I'd probably take it one step further, that you have to sort of know in your life and in your career when enough is enough. Because whatever you do, you know, I mean, there will always be someone in town who's busier than you or makes more money, or if you're in academics, who's writing more papers or has more research grants or more accolades or more, whatever it is, there's always going to be someone who has more of it. Yeah. And if you're always measuring yourself relative to others, it's very easy to just sort of get on this never-ending ladder and just keep reaching higher and higher for these rungs that honestly maybe don't even matter to you, and maybe they're even harmful. You know, maybe making an extra $20,000 or $30,000 or $50,000 a year doesn't actually impact your quality of life in a favorable way because you don't have time to enjoy it. Yeah. You know, or we could come up with other examples. So I think that kind of gets to the advice that I was giving, back at the beginning when you put me on the spot for your pre-meds. But I think it's true. You've got to, you always want to be the best you can be. But being the best you can be it can't necessarily mean giving every single ounce of everything that you have and every single thing that you're putting yourself into. You've got to come to terms with that at some point in your medical career, or you'll suffer for not coming to terms with it.
Yeah. I think it falls back on just a lot of self-awareness, self-reflection. What do you want out of your life, from a work-life balance, from a family standpoint? Do you want to be able to play in the local beer softball league twice a week and be okay with that and not be on call? Or do you want to be the world-renowned left pinky surgeon and make a name for yourself for that? So it's a lot of self-awareness that's needed as you're building your career. So one of the things that I'm concerned about, that a lot of people are concerned about, with more medical schools means more graduates. And for people who don't know, the number of residency spots is typically tied to funding that is done through Medicare, and that hasn't changed much. And there are private residency programs out there that come and go, that fluctuate the number of residency spots. What is your big concern when it comes to more schools and more potential applicants to applying to residency programs?
Yeah, I think you touch on sort of a big and important issue, which is that, I think anyone would agree, you know, the purpose of medical education, whether it's residency, fellowship, undergraduate medical education, whatever it is, the purpose is to train a workforce to care for the people in our country. However, we have these different steps of that process that all function independently. And there's not a sort of a single vision of someone saying, well, you know, we need a distribution of working physicians that looks like such and such. And therefore, we need to train this many people through medical school, and we need to have residency programs that sort of approximate this ideal distribution. That doesn't occur. Instead, individual schools make the decision about whether they should expand or not, and they do so based on sort of hyper-local variables. I mean, do they have the space? What would it cost? What would it bring in? You know, could they get it through the LCME or COCA, you know, the accreditation bodies? And none of that has anything necessarily to do with whether we need that many more physicians. And residency positions are the same way. I mean, like you said, or alluded to, you know, since 1997, there has been a cap on the amount of money that Medicare, which is historically been the biggest funder of residency positions, will pay for residency positions. Is we're sort of fixed at those 1997 levels. That doesn't mean that hospitals can't expand their residency programs. They can and they do. It just means the hospital's got to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And so what goes into that decision similarly has little to do with whether you need more people in that specialty nationwide or even in your area. It has to do with whether expanding the residency program would bring in financial incentives that exceed what it would take to hire and cover the wages and benefits of a new resident. And so the overall behavior of the system is sort of the sum total of all these individual hyper-local decisions and the direction where we end up. There's certainly no guarantee and there's no guidance trying to steer us in one way or another. It's sort of the sum of all those things. So I think that it is a real concern that, that we're going to go off kilter, you know, for one reason or another, either by, training too many doctors such that, it leads to poor working conditions or reimbursement, or that we'll continue to have, shortages of physicians and, or a distribution of physicians that doesn't match what society needs. I mean, I think all those things are to one extent or another likely. Mm-hmm.
Do you see there's two, and I would love, like, we could deep dive into any of these topics we brought up today, but I'm just like rapid firing going through these with you. Do you see a potential in the future to where, number one, we say no more international medical graduates in our match? Right now, if you run the numbers, there's probably enough room for everyone, US graduates. If you take out international medical graduates, there's plenty of room. Now, that doesn't mean you'll get what you want to do, right? If I want to be an orthopedic surgeon, but my step one score, step two score, whatever you have it, doesn't match that reality, then sure, I'll go match in family practice because there's plenty of those spots, the majority of which are taken by international medical graduates at this point. Do you see a future where the government or someone steps in and says, hey, like, you have to match every U.S. student before you will look at an international medical graduate?
I don't think that's realistically going to occur. And I say that because I think any attempt to do that would be subject to legal challenge. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that it would survive. There are, the Council on Graduate Medical Education, which is the body that advises Congress about these matters. I think historically, some of the initiatives that we mentioned, like capping Medicare funding for GME and so on, those things were really intended to sort of shift the demographics of the physician workforce in a way that would be legally permissible. So I don't think that that will ever occur. And I'd actually even say that many of the big lobbying groups would actually lobby against it, such as academic medical centers. And it's not so much because of, international medical graduates who want to practice clinically, but you've got to remember that these big giant academic medical centers also have enormous research enterprises. Yeah. And scientists who work on a work visa are in high demand to keep those labs running and all of the output that comes from them, much as they are in other industries like tech industry and so on.
Yeah.
So I don't think that will ever occur.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been an issue over the last couple of years with the restriction on visas that were granted. So that's interesting. And then one last potential question before I let you go. Do you see a world where we have a rule, a law, where if you take federal financial aid to go to medical school, that you are required to do 2 years of primary care before you match into a subspecialty.
That's interesting. That's something I haven't thought about before.
Right, because there's a lot of screaming from the AMA, who's a big lobbying body. And so I always take everything they say with a grain of salt, that we have this huge physician shortage that is either we currently have it, there's estimated. And you look at the numbers and it's like, well, we have some here, we have some there. I think we have a physician shortage. I don't think it's as drastic as the AMA says it is. I think we have a distribution, as you had mentioned, inequality of specialties, where people don't want to go into primary care because it doesn't pay as much. It'd be interesting to see, like, hey, everyone who goes to medical school on federal loans, 2 years primary care post-internship, which is what I did. I did the HPSP scholarship, so I did my internship year, and then I went active duty with the military. And during those 2 years, you're going to do primary care. You're going to take care of the population that we need to take care of. We're going to prioritize preventive medicine. And during that time, you don't have to pay any money, and your interest loans also aren't going to go up, right? No compounding interest there.
Yeah, I think it will probably not occur, mainly just for reasons of politics. I mean, I think the most straightforward but also the most difficult solution to fixing, you know, the supply of primary care physicians is simply to pay them better, you know? Yeah. I mean, if you paid primary care physicians, you will see a shift in people wanting to do primary care to the extent that you pay them more. But of course, that's also, you know, we're just not in a healthcare environment where any payer wants to pay any physician any more. And to pay primary care physicians more would require paying someone else less, and no one's eager to be that person, you know, to do that. So it makes it a challenging political issue that it's hard to imagine that coming to pass, but I suppose it is possible.
Yeah. I love thought experiments like that. So it's fun. Well, Brian, I had a blast talking with you. I would love to take a couple of these subjects at some point in the future and do deep dives into them, because I think it's all valuable information that students, either currently medical students or those primarily of this audience, students thinking about going to medical school or wanting to go to medical school, should be aware of, so that they can think about it, talk about it, and like we talk about it in medicine all the time, have informed consent about what they're doing for their future. So I'll put you back on the spot. My audience, the pre-med students, one parting word of wisdom for them.
About being a pre-med,
just
or about
life in general, physicianhood. just if you could go back, let's frame it this way: if you could go back and tell yourself your pre-med self something, what would that be?
I think I would say, and I think I think I've done a pretty good job of this, but I still think it's good advice, is to stay curious. You know, when something piques your curiosity, don't be afraid to pick at it a little bit. I mean, it's tempting, you know, when you're studying for your chemistry final or something, and you know that something's not going to be on there, it's beyond the scope of what's on the exam, but you see something and you wonder about how it is. It's tempting to say, man, that's not high yield. I'm going to focus on exactly what's going to be on that exam and nothing more. But sometimes, you know, your understanding is unlocked, or you'll get greater joy by following your curiosity. And the same thing when you're, you know, when you're on the wards. I mean, when a finding doesn't make sense, when, you know, you hear something and it just makes you wonder, give yourself a little bit of time every day. Just sort of indulge that curiosity, and where that takes you often will be good places that leave you better off or more enriched, or you know, take you down roads that you didn't even know existed.
All right, there you have it again, Dr. Brian Carmody, the Sheriff of Sodium, talking about some potential osteopathic vulnerabilities. It was a very interesting discussion. Great video. Again, if you just go to YouTube and search for the Sheriff of Sodium, you can watch the video on his channel there. Again, if you want more of this with Dr. Carmody, let me know, because it was a great discussion. I could have talked over and over and over more, longer with Dr. Carmody. So, great discussion. Before we end, I want to talk about the MCAT Minutes brought to you by Blueprint MCAT. As we're recording this, as this episode is coming out, it is now February. We're in a little hiatus for MCAT tests because for some reason the AAMC doesn't test in February. But if you are taking the test soon, don't forget to check out Blueprint MCAT and Sketchy's partnership, where you can get access to Blueprint's amazing full-length exams and Sketchy's great new MCAT platform to help you learn and memorize and retain all of that information to help you get the score you need on your MCAT. Go check it out at blueprintmcat.com. Hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time here on The Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.